We can start.
It's your turn.
I'm really no good at these things.
Welcome to another episode of Fags and Thoughts. I'm your host, Carrie.
hear ye, for a new episode of Fags and Ye Fonts. All presiding.
We have the honorable...
No, we're actually going to do an intro.
Yeah, okay. See, that would have been fun.
That would have been a good intro.
Yeah, it's going to be a great intro to the show before we do the real intro.
We have the honorable Judge Kiri presiding.
A judge?
Yes.
Judge?
Yes.
I'm judging you, that's for sure.
I'm Judge Kiri.
The superior admiral voice.
And then there's Ocean.
Yeah, there's Ocean.
Priest King Ocean.
Priest King... What?
Priest King Ocean.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Welcome to another episode of Fangs and Fonts. I'm Kiri.
I'm Ocean.
I'm Voice.
And you're stealing my bit.
I sure am.
So for this episode, we are going to do two mini topics because we didn't really have a big topic. And quite frankly, one of our mini topics was suggested by one of our listeners, one of our new listeners, Royce Day, who is a talented author who has self-pubbed a lot of his works and also been in a fair amount of anthologies within the fandom. So he wanted to hear us talk about using illustrations in books, be they anthologies or books. Are they good or are they bad? Let's talk about it.
Does this include the cover?
I think we should talk about covers as well, because I think covers are excruciatingly important.
Incredibly so. People totally do judge a book on its cover.
They very totally do. So should we talk about covers first?
Sure.
Let's jump into it.
With covers, so one of the things that I learned putting together two anthologies for Fur Planet, Abandoned Places and Bleak Horizons, is when I did the cover for... I wanted complete control for the cover. So when I did Abandoned Places, I got a talented artist by the name of Cappy to do actually both covers. So when I did Abandoned Places, it was fairly easy. No real issues with the cover. It was three characters fairly close up. And it was very eye-catching. So I figured, hey, that was pretty easy. So let's do the cover for Bleak Horizons. So when I presented it to Fuzz and Tyrion, the initial picture had been a full-body shot of a tiger in a power armor with a gun being surrounded by these shadowy things. And the first thing they said is, I wish you had approached us about this because this doesn't work. And I was mortified. What the heck are you talking about? And they said, well, one of the things with covers is you tend to get drawn in by facial expressions and whatnot. So if you, for a cover, especially with one character, it's better if you do like the bust of the character, because that way you're drawn more to their facial expression. You're more drawn to them as themselves. And actually, in that regards, you can see that a lot in romance novels where generally they try to have it as close as possible to the couple on the cover, while also keeping it titillating and showing enough skin and, ooh, you might see a naughty bit here and there to keep it interesting. So they ended up reworking the cover for Bleak Horizons so that it was pretty much a zoom in on the tiger's head with the same shadowy monster things around it. And I was a little bit put off at first about it, but the more and more I looked at it, the more and more I realized, yeah, you know what? They actually were right. It actually was a far more empowering, far more eye-catching cover than what I had originally suggested. And that's kind of where I started to realize covers were an extremely important thing. Having done two covers for Armored Fox, Perfect Tales, which has a full body but kneeling catgirl, and This Book is Cursed, which is meant to look like an actual cursed book, you really start to learn a lot about what catches a reader's attention and whatnot, because as Ocean said, people will judge a book by its cover. It is, you know, the first thing they do when they pull it out of a table at a con or out of the shelf at a bookstore is they look at the cover, and if it's interesting, they'll open the book or read the back blurb. If it's uninteresting, they're just going to put it back and continue on.
Well, what Tarl said was right. As a book reader, like a voracious book reader, I am one of the many people that will judge a book by its cover. When I'm trying to jump into something new or something, a genre that I've never read before, I'm more inclined to look at the cover and see if the cover is eye-catching to me. A cover that has more eye-catching or appealing cover is one that I'm more likely to pick up, read the blurb, and if the blurb on the back gets me, I'm more inclined to buy it than if it's just, say, the title and a single color. With the furry fandom, I kind of like to see furries in active poses as if they're doing something from the story. For me, it was bonus points if it's from an actual story in the anthology. I know some people have varying thoughts on whether the cover should be from a story within the anthology or versus one a general idea of the anthology. But I'm kind of like, I kind of like to see a story illustrated from the anthology.
Well, the reason for illustrating a story within the anthology is that you can then use it to sell. If people like the image on the cover, you can tell them, oh, that's this story on page 63.
And usually it's really good for a nice morale boost for those who are in the anthology for them to sit there and...
You got the cover story.
When one of my stories got the cover for Taboo, I mean, that one very much sits there and states the story. You have the Black Panther teacher in the background with the panda girl clutching a slightly pregnant belly in the foreground, drawn by Kadith. And it's amazing, and that tells you everything that's happening right there, or at least gets you interested enough where you're like, hey, I want to see more.
Yeah, that's definitely the reason why I picked up Taboo. I saw that cover, and I was like, wait, what? I was like, because I know it kind of played on some of the kinkier aspects of it, of like the student-teacher dynamic, and I was like, this is something that I could see myself really reading and picking up, so... Of course, again, when I picked up the book and read the back blurb, I was like, yep, this is definitely one that I want.
And that's exactly it, is you're sitting there to try to present a certain point of the story, to pull in the reader, so they sit there and they go, holy crap, I want to read this, I want to know what's going on in this cover. And it's interesting when you start paying attention to cover designs. And I know there's even a TED Talk on doing covers and like how the cover artist for Jurassic Park ended up coming up with the cover for that book, and which became the cover for the icon for the movie. And it's just a case of you want to draw them, you want to state something from the story, you want to present something that's interesting. A really fun exercise to do that I do fairly often is I go on to, there's a lot of pay for cover art websites out there. That's where I got the cover for This Book is Cursed, for a steal of a deal, no less. And you go on there and just look through people's covers that they've generated, because it's people who are selling covers that they've made themselves using clip art and whatnot. And you can tell those who have some kind of artistic or design skill versus those that are just throwing slapdash stuff together. Because you'll have like the ones where, you know, it's a Viking. And you've got there and it's his torso and it's a ripped, you know, ripped muscles, and he might have some battle wounds and whatnot. And that's very engaging versus the far away Viking who's got some axes and looks like he's kind of lost in the woods because he doesn't know where to go. Well, which is more appealing to people who are going to pick it up? Quite frankly, the muscular Viking, because someone's going to look there and be like, oh, is there Viking sex in this? Not really, but you get the picture there.
Yeah, like, cover doesn't necessarily always sell the book, but it's definitely the first thing that anyone's going to see. They have to reach out, grab the cover to look at it, and, you know, other than word of mouth, that's the first thing that's going to attract them to your book.
Well, look at...
Plus, it's not necessary that you have to have the most amazing cover. It's more important you have a cover that is not repulsing people away.
Yes.
I think that's the more important thing. If you have an amazing cover, it's going to look amazing. But if it's a fine cover... That's not bad either. It's just don't have a bad cover, because then, nobody, you don't even want to, I'm done.
Yeah, it's an uninteresting cover. You never want a cover that looks unfinished, even if that's not the intent. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to look like it was thrown slapdash together. You can always tell the clip art covers where you're just like, what the heck is this about? What's this story about? What's going on? And that said, you don't want... I'm kind of on the fence when it comes to minimalistic covers. You can have some really beautiful minimalistic covers out there, but you really have to be that much on point to get the point of your story across or to tell the story that you want to tell. A good example of this is there is a book that I picked up that I've been trying to struggle my way through it for the last few years called The Spider Within Her. The story is about a woman who's cursed by a paranormal / urban fantasy. Woman is cursed with a revenge spirit that just happens to turn her into a giant were-spider, and she goes and she kills the men who abuse the women she protects in a women's shelter. The cover of the book is a picture of a forest and the title of the book. What does that tell you about the story? Nothing.
I think maybe there'd be a forest somewhere in here or something going on. Someone gets lost.
Which there isn't, because it takes place in the middle of a friggin' city.
While a good cover may possibly sell a book, it may or may not, because some people just aren't book readers. At the very least, they'll say, hey, I have this book that has this adorable or fantastic cover, and I just bought it because I love the art. A bad cover will definitely sink your book. I know I have been turned off from books that have had wonderful, wonderful things inside of them and would have been geared towards me, but I was just so turned off from the cover. It's like, no, I think I'll pass.
I kind of want to, because I sold this last year, and I kind of want to take it apart and kind of look at it. By the way, in Human Acts, that's a good cover.
That is a lovely cover.
I agree.
I'm kind of jealous of that cover. So Fang Volume 7, the Las Vegas themed one.
Oh, yeah.
Because I sold it last year at Furry. So you've seen this. Or Ocean can just go get his copy.
That's you have it in your office, don't you?
Yeah.
Oh, there's every... Nope. I think you have it in your office.
I'll go get it.
It's the one Fang I'm in.
So... I know this. I know this relatively well because I ended up doing a bedtime story reading from one of the stories in it. But you look at it as a cover, and first of all, it gets across very well the fact that, you know, this is a male-male anthology. Which, for those that have never heard me talk about this, it took me actually a couple of years to find out that Fang was male-male only, and this was after I had a story accepted into it, which was the infamous Boner Kill story.
You just got lucky on it, or what?
Well, because it was about...
I guess I'll write a story for that. You know what? I'll write a male-male one for that one. Maybe they'll take it. I don't know if that's in a real...
Well, that's exactly it. So, and I mean, I just lucked out. But I mean, the art is crisp. It's clear. It's a cougar. I believe that's a cougar. And a rabbit.
Yep.
And you have... male package prominently on the cover. And all in all, it gets across. This is a male-male anthology. This is going to be dirty. You know, this is what it is. But the theme of the anthology is Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And when you look at this cover...
It doesn't say Las Vegas.
It doesn't say Las Vegas. So when... when I'm selling this book...
Granted, there's a lot of hotel rooms in Vegas.
There is a lot of hotel rooms. And to my congrats to the artist, because quite frankly, it's very apparent it's a hotel room. And I don't know, looking at the picture, exactly why that might be the case, but it very much just feels like a hotel room. But the thing is your overall theme of Las Vegas is lost. And since I was at Furay last year, which theme was Las Vegas, and I was selling it because it was Las Vegas themed... I had to tell people this is Las Vegas themed, because they would go, why are you selling Volume 7 and not Volume 1? And I would reply with, well, this is Las Vegas themed. I ended up having to put it on the sign, Las Vegas themed. And I still sold a number of copies, but the reason being is people would just look at it and go, they would pick it up because it's two males about to go at it, rather than the fact that it was Las Vegas themed. And that's one of the things with those thematic anthologies, is where, take for example, In Flux. In Flux's cover is really well done. It is a very nice transition between human and animal, or vice versa, where the person is clearly in shock, they're clearly transforming, and the artwork is beautifully done.
Yep.
And that tells you enough about the story. Kyle Gold's Green Fairy series. Those covers are beautiful. I absolutely love them. And they also give you an idea of what the story is about. And I mean, those are art pieces that I would love to hang on my wall because they're absolutely stunning. That said, I've also in the fandom seen a lot of covers where you look at it and you go, what is this telling me about this anthology?
Yeah, there was recently a cover that I saw that it was a really fantastic anthology and it had some interesting stories in it. But to me, the cover came across kind of wrong in that it was a prominent male character. And the image to me, it seemed like it was basically a gay male erotica anthology. Like, I thought it should be the cover for Fang. And apparently it was not. And I kind of was a little off put because I'm like, oh, okay, well, I thought it was one thing. And then I open it up and it's a bunch of different stories. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, this is different.
What about the interior art? We see less and less of it each time nowadays.
So
who's still doing interior art these days?
I know Howl is, Thurston Howl Press.
And Heat.
Heat is doing...
Hot Dish.
I think Hot Dish does, yeah.
Okay.
And apparently Armored Fox, my own Foxers and Briefs, is going to have some interior art. I'm not sure if Fur Planet's doing it anymore. I know Fur Planet stepped away from doing interior art just because they kind of felt differently about it. And this is where we kind of get into an area. And I'm going to kind of go on a bit here. With interior art, from a publishing standpoint, it's a bit weird. Because on one hand, interior art, when it's done really well, and I'll talk about that, is amazing. It enhances the story. It's great. But when it's done wrong, it actually hinders your entire anthology and actually kind of pushes people away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But from a publisher, you are paying out, anywhere from $100 to $200 per art piece, unless you're really lucky or you're really underpaying your artists. You're adding that cost to your book. For example, with Abandoned Places, where I hired Silent Raven to do the artwork, I got a fairly good deal on that. But at the same point, I will never, in the entirety that Abandoned Places is for sale, ever make my money back. Just because with Abandoned Places, the overhead cost for everything, for me to put that entire anthology together between the cover art, the interior art, and the paying of the authors, just was so huge. And I'm okay with that. I would rather that the writers got paid. I would rather the artists got paid. But at the same point, does it enhance the anthology? Does it make it look good? Well, the interior art's only been mentioned in one review. So does it enhance? I don't know. And I know kind of Fur Planet looked at interior art and kind of went, well,
it's just too costly.
Yeah, we're spending so much money on this. It doesn't seem like it's adding to the story all that much. Maybe we should pull away from that. I think that was a good move. I think that's actually a good move for most publishers. As in an environment where we want to start paying authors more, it's really hard to sit there and justify not paying your authors at all. And yet still paying for interior art because all you're doing is saying that your artists are worth paying and your writers are not. And that is not the way you kind of want to go around that.
Yeah, if you want a book filled with art, that's called an art book.
And those are amazing.
Those are a completely different product, though.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Yeah, I think if we, even in our craziest of craziest thoughts, ever thought about saying, hey, we're going to create a book and we're not going to pay the artists for the cover or for the interior art, we would probably have a couple of riots on our hands while also being chased out of the fandom. But nobody really bats an eye at the thought of authors being paid nothing. After like our whole little fiasco or that massive discussion that we had, some people are still okay with not paying authors or with authors being seen as less than or their contribution to the fandom is not as important as the artist. And that's really not fair to us.
Does interior art help in selling an anthology or a novel? I'm gonna present some positive examples. Windfall. You've all heard me talk about Windfall. It's one of my favorite furry books, But Windfall has interior art. It's not, some of it's full page, some of it is just little inserts. But what is nice about it is, first of all, some of the art was created as kind of a way of promoting the novel and getting people's attention drawn towards the novel by the artist. But the art itself really encapsulates, thank you, the what's going on in the story. It's really helping to push the storyline, but it's also there as fan service. You do have the regular pictures, but you also have the showering otter, the full outright them having sex, things like that, which are there to, you know, to entice the reader, which is a good idea. And I say that because I've been reading a lot of Japanese light novels recently. And if you want to look at proper ways of doing interior illustrations, you have to look at light novels, because that's something that is very important to light novels, is having interior art, to the point where when you buy a light novel, it is written by so-and-so, interior art by so-and-so. The artist is given the same amount of cover space as the writer is. Because
you get a bio in the back too.
And that's exactly, and they have little blurbs written from the artist to the reader, as well as the author's blurb. But usually those pictures are fan service pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Mixed bathing in another world. What's one of the interior pictures? Two naked girls crouch down in front of a washing machine because they're in a fantasy world and washing machines are amazing. How not to summon a demon lord. Newly summoned Lolita demon lord, naked, with an elf who is mostly naked. You don't see anything, but it's very much, here's fan service for reading this far. But that sells. And that's usually what you end up coming across with light novels, is you have those fan service moments where something happens and here's something titillating just to tease you. Or here's a really good action scene. Here's a, you know, picture of what that action could have looked like. And the weird thing that light novels do that weirds me out a bit is they will actually have snippets from the book at the front of the book. They will have a scene where the final confrontation between Ocean and the Dark Lord drawn out before you even get there. Here's a picture of their confrontation. You flip to the next page. Here's a picture of when he had that beautiful dinner with Kiri. Here's, you know, here's when they went hunting with Voice. And it's just, and it's much like the little blurbs that you get at the front of books were to entice you to read further. It's the same thing, only it's visual. And it really sits there and goes, okay, in this book, clearly there's going to be a giant confrontation. Here's what it looks like. Here's going to be this fantastic romantic moment. Here's what it looks like. Here's this whatever. Let's go on. And I really, really like that. That said, I've also come across light novels where the interior artist was a little less competent, and it takes me out of the story as I stare at the picture trying to figure out where that thumb came from. And this is where I get to the downside of interior art, is if you have a bad choice of interior art, it can decimate not only your sales or the anthology, but also your writers. I have experienced both sides of this. In my first anthology, and I'm sorry, Reachin, my first anthology that I was ever published in, which was Will of the Alpha, when my girlfriend at the time got my copy, she opened it up, she opened it to my story, and saw the interior art. She snapped a photo on her phone and she sent it to me. I was, I think, at work or something at that. And I got the picture and I was devastated. I was devastated to the point of tears. I was ready to give up my entire writing career because of the interior art of that anthology. It wasn't sexy. It was clearly drawn by a muscle fur. I was just mortified. As the years have gone by, I'm over it. It is what it is. It is some, you know, everything is someone's fetish, and some people really like it. I don't. But again, that was my first published story, so I was also most likely hypersensitive to it. When I did Abandoned Places, one of my writers thought that their artwork was far too cutesy, and was mortified at just how cute I made their character, who was supposed to be this absolute grotesque character and all that. And I had to end up talking to them and just kind of explaining why I went with the artist that I did, why I went the route that I did, rather than doing what they envisioned in their story.
Yeah, because they didn't work with you on it or anything.
No.
It was just, here's your art.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is I told the artist what I wanted, they responded, and for the most part, I was happy. And so I understand where the editors are coming from, where it's like, I have this art, and, you know, the writer doesn't like it. And I understand being that writer who absolutely dislikes completely the stuff that, you know, that has been done for him. But again, this goes back to, is it enhancing? Because unlike a novel where you have little plot points that are decked out and done in really good art, with an anthology, it's just kind of like a brief picture of what's going to happen in the story. And I think that has significantly less of an impact. Probably one of the best anthology art ideas that I've ever come across is for Dungeon Grind, where they went with silhouettes. And I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Here's a silhouette. It's easy to print. It's easy to art. But it also tells you exactly what you're in for in the story. Here is my story in that anthology, where it's a giant horned monster and a anthropomorphic bear. Done. That's all you need to know. Read the story.
With cover art, I do think that it should really add to it. When people, I think sometimes having sat a couple of times behind publisher tables where they're selling books, having seen some people sometimes flip through the books looking for pictures, most of the time the people that are looking for in-depth cover art like that aren't really the people that are going to buy the books. Like, the people that are going to buy the books, the pictures are kind of meh for them, because usually they're making up the characters in their head. They're using their own imaginations to envision what these characters look like. And the characters are more endeared to them in that way. Do I feel as if we should be spending, like, hundreds up to thousands of dollars on cover art for stories, for, like, an anthology? Not really. When it comes to like a novel for, say, maybe a best-selling author or an author that has some clout within the fandom, then I'd say, yeah, probably, if the story warrants it, or if it's like something that ties into the story and kind of gives a little depth to it. But usually I just kind of feel like interior art is a bit overkill.
I was going to say, actually, that reminded me, one of the other best uses I've ever seen of interior art is a lot of the old Dragonlance books, where you would get to a new chapter and right above the chapter number would be a little landscape or a character, just a little simple drawing, just to kind of get you in the mood of, okay, this is clearly taking place in a spooky forest, or this is clearly a dragon's horde, or this is clearly some kind of monster or something like that. And it was just a little tiny drawing, but it broke it up, and it was in a good place, being at the start of a chapter where you're just like, oh, there's a chapter. There's a nice picture. Sweet. You continue on reading. With the interior art, only once have I ever had someone open up a book, go, specifically the words were, oh my god, this picture of this character masturbating into this river of lava is so hot, I'm buying this anthology. To which I went, what? But they did. All based off of this one picture.
You can't tell people why not. They won't buy stuff. It's up to them. Like, as much as it's, a lot of people don't care too much about the interior art because they already have their own pictures. For some, it helps set the baseline of that picture already in your mind, so then you already have that picture as you read the story, right? It's kind of like when you read a book and then they put it on a movie and you're like, that's not what it should look like at all, because everyone has their own individual picture in their mind palace, in their head. If you're having interior art, it's not a bad thing, because now everyone has similar pictures or something. It gives you maybe a sense for it, but it's also like not needed.
And that's where with light novels it plays more of a role, because especially with light novels, they're gunning to get an anime, because that's where the money is. You do your light novels, you get your publishing rights, and then you get an anime, and then you get republishing of your stuff plus anime rights and all that. And people will sit there and watch the anime and be like, oh yeah, that's so-and-so, because that's exactly how they were drawn in the light novel, and that's exactly what they look like. Whereas with anthologies, you're not really dealing with long-run stories, so it's really less important. And if you're going to put it in your actual novel, then you kind of have to, you know, make sure you're putting it in for the right reasons and at the right locations. Because otherwise, it's just going to get lost in the mix and no one's really going to care.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if you want to put interior art in your book, by all means, go ahead. Just realize that it's really going to up the cost much more than you expect.
And that's, and honestly, as someone who's going to be doing his own light novel, the fact that I'm looking at interior art at $150 per art piece.
It's one of those things that people don't think of, I feel. But when they see it, they're like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, cool. That's neat.
That's neat.
And then they continue on, right? I don't see people go, oh, there's no art with these words. I can't read without the pictures. Those aren't generally the people you're attracting with your book.
It's nice to have art. It's nice to have one or two pieces in it. You don't need it. As Ocean said, you're going to think your own world. You're going to have your own vision of these characters. You know, you don't need it. In cases like Windfall, it definitely does help. It definitely does enhance the story.
Especially when you're doing a key scene or something, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because there's one thing where it's like so-and-so walks into this room. So-and-so is taking a shower in classical tropish fashion. And then there so-and-so is
looking at themselves in the mirror to describe themselves.
But it's like there's picture of so-and-so in the shower. And you're like, the sexual tension up to this point has been high. There's the description of said character showering. There's picture of said character showering. And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you have now taken what was already fairly high sexual tension and now amped it up so that, you know, you might have to just put that book down for a bit or just somehow find a way of propping it open while you have some
time. The one-handed read.
Yes.
Some may call it.
There's girls there.
I need some help in here, honey.
Yeah, so our next point is called Get to the Point, as a matter of fact. Lately, I've been doing a lot of reading. But then again, it's like, when do I not do a lot of reading? But as I've done slush paw reading, as I've done reading things outside of the fandom, as I've done reading of my own stuff, I've noticed that as I shift my reading away from fandom-derived works, I notice that these stories are really, like, from the first line, or the opening, the first line that opens the story, it's right in there, it's attention-grabbing, it kind of holds you there by the seat of your pants, and it doesn't let you go until the end of the story. When I took this knowledge back to slush pile reading for a few anthologies in the fandom, I've noticed that a lot of people take anywhere from 3 to, at one point it was 10 pages, to get to the point of the story.
And just to start the story.
Just to start the story. It's like, I've learned, in these 10 pages, I've learned what the character has eaten for breakfast. I've learned how they're feeling about their boyfriend. I've learned what color their shoes are. I've learned how many times they've gone to the mirror to investigate themselves. What I haven't learned is why I'm reading the story. They haven't told me why I should care about the story or given me any questions that I would want answers that'll be answered by reading the entire story. And I'm wondering, like, how do we get to the point, really? How do we start our story where it actually starts instead of meandering along and going 10 pages before we actually get to a plot or anything of relevance?
Well, that's one of the things that they say when you're writing your novel. Usually the first thing you do is you chop the first chapter or two off, because that's usually where people are working on it and they're getting up to speed, and then they finally hit that point and then they're going. But by then they've written a chapter or two of rambling. Now they're at the point. So if you just chop off that beginning part, then you get rid of all the boring stuff and you literally just start. And I mean, just when you were describing the stories there, it was kind of just in my head. I was kind of going through a little scenario of there, so-and-so, they wake up in the morning, they get dressed, they look in the mirror in the standard. He was a 6-foot-tall wolf with black fur with a white stripe over his left eye. He put on dark indigo jeans and sneakers and
get
a plaid shirt with an ascot. And then he went into the kitchen and then he made some toast. And then he grabbed the toast and put it in his mouth and then dashed out the front door down the hallway. It was then that he was attacked by the secret ninja. Okay, well, what's more interesting? The follow-up or the he's getting attacked by a ninja? So why don't you start with the he's attacked by a ninja and go from there. Even if you do the neat trick of starting with the battle and being like, I had thought it was all an interesting morning. I had gotten up. At least they know that there's a fight with a ninja that's happening and they're going to get back to it.
It's like, I'm reading this and it's like, oh, okay, whoa, ninjas, where'd that come from? And I think that's how your stories really go. It's like your ninja moment should be right there, like, bam. Like, one of the stories I read, they start off, it's like, they opened the person's mouth and poured the drink down and helped massage it because the corpse had been dead for a few hours. And I was like, wait, what? So I had to continue reading this.
Well, look at Star Wars. Started the first Star Wars movie. Princess Leia's ship attacked by the Star Destroyer. Like, right then and there, starts off an action. That keeps you intrigued, and it keeps you interested, and it keeps you on there. Take the first prequel movie, where it's, oh, we're going to fly onto this ship. Oh, we're going to walk through. Oh, we're going to sit there and talk. Oh no, now they're going to gas us. What's more interesting? What gets to the point and, like, instantly, you know, ship in white being attacked by a ship that is gray. Big battle, boarding. Big guy in black evil suit. Uniform troopers that are reminiscent of Nazi Germany. Big gun battle. Choking someone to death. It gets to the point. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. Someone is trying to explain or escape or transmit something from the bad guys who clearly want it bad enough to choke people to death.
Oh, yeah. The inciting action is, quick, get this to Ben or whatever, right?
You know
what?
Yeah.
What do you have to get? What is, who is this Ben? Who's, like, it just immediately dumps a bunch of questions and setting and world all in once and goes whoosh. Again, right?
And I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't realize is you don't need to sit there and do an exposition dump of these are all things. Questions are good.
Yeah, I want to, your story should start with some sort of question, like a conflict. Something has happened, and how are we going to resolve it? I can find out about the world throughout this quest. I can find out about the character throughout this quest.
Yeah.
What I need to know right now is, what is the point of reading your story? Because I would like to know that so I know to read the rest of it rather than, oh, there's no point. I'll stop.
As a note, it doesn't have to be a literal question. Some people have done that and it into entertaining effect, but it doesn't always have to be a literal question like, what are you doing or where are you going? It could be a character is running down the street. And, of course, most people are like, why is this person running?
That's a question.
Mentally, you'll ask, why is this person running?
Well, I don't mean you should have a literal question. I mean,
that's what
your
I
conflict
said.
Should bring about some sort of like, a sort of conflict where, like, the question is, well, where do we go from here? Or how do we solve this? Or what now? Or what is going on? Like it's usually is a plot arc is, we have a question, and we're hoping at the end it's answered. And even along the way, we might get small answers, but when we get an answer, we get a new question generally. You know, we get an answer, but. Like, there's the yes, but, or no, ands kind of way of plot continuation, if you've heard of those.
And you can still do have your quieter moments to have things kind of come together. This whole thing kind of made me think of the pilot episode of Rick and Morty, where literally the entire episode starts with Rick coming into Morty's bedroom, going, you know, in a blind panic, we need to go, we need to go, we need to go, let's go, I've got this thing. He drags him out, and instantly you're invested. You're like, who is this person? Why does he need Morty, and what's going on? And then they're in a spaceship, and they're talking. And it's a long scene where they're just talking about that until they're like, oh yeah, I'm going to bomb everything here, flip the neutrino bomb on. You know, at that point, you're reinvested, but at that point, you're already dragged into the story because you want to find out why Rick has dragged Morty out of bed in the middle of the night in a blind panic saying, come with me, you need to come with me. And then they're in a spaceship.
Yep.
That he built himself, and you're like, what's going on here? And they're not hand-feeding you bits of, you know, like huge exposition dumps. You're getting these little bits and where you're like, okay, he built it out of trash in the garage. Clearly, he's a genius of some sort. Clearly, he has a drinking problem because of the amount of belching and drooling he's doing.
He comes in as blindly drunk into Morty's room in the middle of the night. Also, as a note, like, the way that Dan Harmon tells the story, the creator, Dan Harmon and Justin Roiland, the way that they tell a story is broken down on Wisecrack, and it's wonderful. If you're ever wondering, like, how do you start a story or how do you tell a story, please check out that video because it really opened my eyes to a lot of the possibilities. But as Tarl was saying, you're thrown right headfirst into the action of it. You're wanting all these questions answered. It's not, hey, Morty, I built this ship in my basement. I need you to come with me. We're going to go drop a neutrino bomb. It's like, hey, get up. I'm drunk. Yes, we're going to leave. We're going to do interstellar travel. We have to figure this out now.
And that's exactly it. It's attention grabbing. And again, that's why usually with novels, they'll chop off the first part of it, is because usually that's when you're sitting there describing, you know, the town they live in and stuff like that. And it's kind of like, I have a very vague memory of The Song of Fire and Ice when I started reading it. The only thing I can remember is when I started reading it, I was bored out of my mind. And I didn't make it very far before I just set it aside and went, you know what? I am done. This is over. I am not really... I don't care that they walked along and I don't know what the heck they were doing. And oh, look, there's fluffy direwolf puppies that are going to make people buy huskies and then abandon them because they're not direwolves. And it's just nothing happens. Even in Lord of the Rings... You have Bilbo's birthday. Stuff happens. He freaks out all the other hobbits, and it goes on. I don't know. Just read your story. Ocean had a really good panel at RF about action scenes. And just think to yourself, you know, if I was sitting down watching this, would I be invested? Would I be interested in what's going on?
An important thing is that, everything in your story should do three things. Advance the plot, advance the character, or provide atmosphere. And that atmosphere one is a bit trickier because a lot of people will, that's where people start doing exposition dumps and be like, oh, my world has this and this is in the world and you see all this and you see all that. And you have to realize that, yeah, sure, it's great getting that out in your first draft and going, dump, I've really done some world building. And then, but you have to realize that you've just taken a dump and I don't want to see your dump. Please remove it and sprinkle it throughout.
Fertilize your story with this.
There's a reason first drafts are first drafts, right? So you have to sit there and go, after a while, going, okay, I've done like a whole page where I've talked about the city that they live in and what the life is like and what the city line is like. And sit there and think, has anything actually happened? What is the point of reading all of this? Do I need to dump it all right here? Can I sprinkle it in throughout? Like, can I have a character who's now on their quest to do something, talking about the bright lights in the city or something? There's much easier ways of taking all this stuff that you really want to put in there because it's exciting world building. It really paints a nice picture. But if you're preventing me from wanting to read further.
And this is where, if you look back at older writings from like the 20s and the 30s, especially in the horror genre, and the pace is slower than a snail. It goes on and on and on. And you're like, can I pluck my eyes out, please? I'm bored with this. And the reason is because as time has gone on, we have started to learn to consume media faster and faster. There is a reason that light novels and now what are called phone novels are getting to be super popular in Japan is because literally they are novels that you can read on your phone. They're formatted to read on your phone because you have people who are on transit. People are used to logging on to YouTube, logging on to Facebook, and basically getting media within seconds. And that's where novels are starting to sort of get like the die down and to a degree. I'm finding that a lot of novels are getting bigger, which seems kind of counterproductive, but you're also now seeing a lot of the large companies doing novellas rather than novels because they realize that people are reading these on the bus. They're reading these when they have a brief moment away from their screaming brats or they're, you know, they've managed to get a little bit of time out of school and they're bite size. You can sit there and read half a novella in one sitting and not feel bad about it and know what's going on and come back to it at the end of the day and finish it and be like, yay, I read a book.
I mean, if you look at the way that we consume all of our media now, like, with the exception of Avengers Endgame, which sits at a hefty 3 hours, most people's attention spans are not that long. With the way that we consume the news, we get our news in bites. Most people, I know I'm one of them, we go to Twitter to to find out our news rather than sitting and looking at a newscast where they repeat it every hour on the hour. We can't wait that long.
That's why you have two tickers on the bottom.
Oh, man, I can't
wait. A slow ticker and a fast ticker for two different headlines.
But that's the thing is, and you, so when you write, think, have that in the back of your head. You're right. Your people, like, you're not writing for the people in the 20s and the 30s where it's a very slow build. Actually, a good example is the movie The Witch. People loved it. It was a slow, slow burn to the horror of it. But a lot of people hated it because, again, it was a slow burn to the actual plot of the story. Most of the time, people, especially if they're not, you know, people who are reading a lot or are used to various kinds of literature, they're just going to want it fast. They want, you know, get to the point, get things going. I want to know what's up with this character. I want to know what's going on. Keep me interested. Keep me going. Keep me wanting to know what's happening. Give me those questions so I can try to solve them or figure them out before I actually get the answer, thrown at me.
Well, when you think about what makes you want to read more in a book, there's things like you're really involved in the character, you're really immersed in the world, and you're interested in where the plot's going, right?
Yeah.
If the story is not, again, contributing to one of those three things, then why do I want to read it?
Exactly.
Like, this is like, I've been reading a bunch of stories where, again, I'm just kind of sitting there going, when does the story start? I really like the story to start because right now I'm just bored.
Yeah.
You haven't hooked me in. You haven't even, you know, done anything to make me go, oh, I got to flip to the next page. You're just going, here's the setup. Here's the character. This is where he lives. This is the city. I'm just like, I'm not interested. And I was talking to someone else about this, because I was reading short stories, and they're like, well, what about a novel? And I immediately thought back to one of the other novels I had read recently, and I thought, you know, even though this is a novel, within five pages, you get a little more leeway with a novel. I was still just blown away by everything that had happened in just five pages, probably less, about just this guy that showed up to a house, and he was here to do a business meeting with a guy. And already the crazy stuff that he'd been told and what the, just like, you've jumped so much onto my lap, but it's things about all these threads, which I'm going to find out later throughout the story. And you've just created all these questions about who is that? Why did they do that? That's a weird thing. Oh, wow. Who's this person?
As opposed to when I was talking earlier when we were off mic about The Faraway Paladin, where it's an isekai novel. The guy dies and he's reincarnated in a baby's body. And the first 50 pages of the book are him growing up. And nothing is more exciting than reading someone growing up. It's about as exciting as a real thing. And I'm sitting there and I pause the book because I'm like, I'm trying to power through it to find out, why is this called The Faraway Paladin? Why is it the City of the Dead? Who are these three undead beings who are teaching him and but not? Instead, I'm treated to, here is the character growing up. Here's a character learning to fight. Here's a character learning to teach
learning magic. But no reason why they're doing that?
And, oh, we'll tell you when you're older. Why we're you
That's
know.
Why I hate that. There's no time to explain. It's yeah. Like, then why did you waste my time?
And I'm sitting there going, like, what is the point? Like, every other book, especially in the isekai genre, it's character dies, character goes to other world, and immediately stuff goes down. And this one, just no, it's I'm going crazy because it's so slow. And it's, I don't want to hear about the political, societal rules and evolution of the entire world.
With short stories, what's the rule of thumb? Like, within two pages, you should really introduce me already to the conflict? Maybe one?
I would say one. I mean, two, if you need to build something, but I mean, realistically,
you've got to give me something.
My most enjoyable stories, the ones that I like the most, like, say, Jericho Tanner and the Ebon Star, mm-hmm. That starts with him dying and him going, you know, man, women are weak. Never seen someone die before. And then him coming back and then doing the, you know, woo, back to where this whole story started. Because, but you're invested at that point. You know, like, okay, he is Jericho Tanner. He is the cat that cannot die. What? And then now you want to know. So you clearly want to continue reading the story as to why this is happening. and a lot of the good short stories I've read, it's within that first, it's called a hook for a reason.
I think an important thing is, if you're struggling with this, like you're like, I want to put so much build up and people are saying that it's taking forever to start my story, just try it and just go immediately put the conflict of the story right there. First page, first paragraph, if you can. Like, you can, if you do your first draft and then you get up to this point and that's where the conflict starts, when you start your second draft, just chop off that first chunk, save it for later, and just see where that goes.
And if an editor tells you, you know, hey, maybe we should chop off that beginning, actually sit there and relook at your story and see if maybe you are guilty of doing this, having the exposition dump or have the drawn out beginning, and just see if I started at the action or at the conflict or at anything that's a little more fast paced, is it actually a better story at that point?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is probably going to always be yes. Yes, it is.
You'd be surprised. Like, it feels kind of, it almost feels like tropish or corny to say, like, you know, you want to have that story that immediately you're thrown into the action, right? Because it's like you have action movies where, you know, it starts out with an explosion or a witty line and something happens and there's a shootout. And so you have no other reaction but to kind of be like, what's going on, right? I'm not advocating you should always do this, but and it's a little harder when you're not writing an action story or something, right? Look at if you're writing a short story, what is the main conflict that you're trying to have throughout this whole entire story? Because generally you only have one main plot line and maybe one or two side, unless you're getting a lot into that short story. And just try to start the story within the first paragraph, two paragraphs, immediately having that conflict shown to us.
It's one reason why prologues.
Oh, yeah,
why people don't recommend you do prologue.
Why the rule of thumb is cut your prologue and cut your epilogue too.
because they're why.
Take it as an appendage.
Yeah.
Put it at the end.
In the beginning of time, the god of death and the god of life were lovers. But then they hated each other and they killed each other. And you will find out why this is important halfway through the book, but it has no play on the beginning. Frick, just show me the battle between the two and start your novel that way.
Right. Just boom.
It was all a dream. What?
Well, that's everything from us this week. We'll talk to you guys next time. If you want, send us an email to fangsandfonts@gmail.com or tweet us @fangsandfonts or just reach out to us individually at our own Twitters. Yeah, we'd love to hear from you guys. What else you want to talk about or any of your thoughts?
As you just heard this episode, I asked him if there's anything he wanted us to talk about, and he said interior illustrations. So here we are.
Otherwise, we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.